You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys will rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take me out.
Give me all you got! Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like me.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to One Heat Minute. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and I have a pretty phenomenal treat for you guys this episode. I'm joined by not only an Academy Award nominee, but a Logie winner as well. I was only expecting an Academy Award nominee, but I've got a Logie winner as well. So Luke Doolin is joining me. You would know him most certainly if you've listened to this podcast from movies like Animal Kingdom or The Gift. He's part of the Blue Tongue Collective. You would see in his work in Gatsby as well as recently Colossal, which is a really awesome dark kaiju movie, which is rad if you've seen it, with Anne Hathaway and Jason Sudeikis. And his buddy, who's just happened to be hanging out at the time, so this is absolutely perfect, Henry Nixon, who's a Logie winner from The Kettering Incident, which is probably one of the best Australian dramas of the last 5-10 years. So check it out. And I quickly went through Henry's resume and saw that he was in East West 101, which is my other favorite Australian drama TV series. So really rad to have both of these gents talking to me. We are at the 137th minute of Heat. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
So, Luke, can you just say hi, it's Luke, so I've got your name so that the audience knows who's talking at each time?
Sure. Hi, it's Luke.
And
hi, it's Henry.
Awesome. Thank you, gentlemen. So, Henry's been dragged into Luke's selection. Luke, being a famous editor, very surprised. He's been roped in to talk about Michael Mann, which he's already said his films are drastically too long. So in a 170-minute movie, I'm glad that I dragged him in for this. But his selection is, and, you know, just saying 137-minute, you may not know if you're not following along the podcast or you haven't been, you're diving in and this is your very first episode. This is the basically 2 minutes in a row we're going to do together, 137 and 138, which is the incredible scene where Charlene Chehalis is sort of forced to go and ID Chris Chehalis, so Ashley Judd forced to ID Val Kilmer with a new haircut, and the incredible gesture of no happens. So we're going to listen to that minute, and then we're going to chat about it.
Take
Gentlemen, well, that's it.
I picked a great clip for radio, didn't I?
There is that is, I think, the benefit of listening to this podcast. Everyone is just listening. And so some scenes are absolutely dynamic and some scenes are just the credits rolling in with Elliot Goldenthal's score. So yeah. Lots of gestures, lots of faces, lots of great little cuts there between a whole bunch of different characters in LA. Luke, thank you so much for joining me on this, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. It's a great idea, this this podcast. I love it.
And so you're a fan of Michael Mann's films or not largely? Because I know that one of your a seminal film for you is Godfathers Part 1 and 2. So this would have been your kink straight from the beginning.
Oh, yeah. Like this came out, what was it, 95, 6?
95, yeah.
So, yeah, I think I was in my last year of school and very much a movie geek, and this is sort of, you know, movie geek cake from hell, you know. But I remember being actually weird, like there was so much hype behind it and I think, you know, whipped up amongst me and my friends, and I remember being weirdly disappointed at the time.
Yes.
Because it was kind of, I don't know, I was very much into sort of flashy camera moves and all that kind of stuff. And this really doesn't have a whole lot of that.
No.
It's got a couple, but it's very, the camera's a long lens and they kind of, you know, very static and for the most part. So I think I kind of put it into the kind of, it's a bit TV category at the time in all my 17-year-old wisdom. But then, you know, I've seen it. I obviously saw it since then, and it just gets better and better each time. And the only other movie I know like that is The Big Lebowski.
Oh, my God. Talk about a film that, yeah, effortlessly rewarding.
Both, very seminal LA film, modern LA film. When did you first see it?
I think it must have been in the late 90s. That's the thing. It's kind of like I'm not really a Heat head.
Not in the cinema, but DVD.
It would have been like maybe DVD or VHS at someone's house, and it was probably like late at night. It was probably in Canberra. It was probably really cold, and I was probably really stoned.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're not a Heat head.
Yeah, I'm not really a Heat head. But
we've had a lot of conversations over the years about Heat.
We have, for some reason. And it's kind of like I've revisited it online, I suppose, in certain scenes and certain stuff, because it does have that kind of actor kind of, you know, that sort of, it's an actor's film because you've got these two greats finally meeting up and butting heads. And to me, I think it's a great example of why I much prefer De Niro over Pacino as an actor.
Oh, really? That's another controversial thing we can go down in a moment. That's great.
I know. It's not really to do with this scene, but I was saying that to Luke earlier. That's purely from an actor's perspective. Yeah.
But there's so much we like. I love the movie, but there's so much to kind of to poke fun at as well, which I really enjoy doing.
Absolutely. So much,
Yeah, you can't help but say great ass. Like if someone even says ass, you just can't help. You make fun of it with love. Like give me all you got, shake the table. You cannot help but it's love poking fun. You love it so much that you're almost allowed. I'm allowed to make fun of it because I love it.
You get back to the actor Pacino De Niro thing, but anytime you make attempt to make an ultra modern film, you know, at a time ultra slick, it immediately dates.
Yes.
So that's one way you can attack it.
That's true.
But it's such a great time capsule of an LA that it doesn't really exist anymore.
It's fantastical, this movie, I think.
Well, it shifts from very grounded to very fantastical.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and to get back to this particular scene, and we were talking about this earlier, this is kind of like a fairy tale scene to me. It's like a fairy tale getaway, and it kind of, it's not really in keeping with the world of the film, but it so is.
Yes. I disagree. I think this is more in keeping with the world than I think the De Niro-Amy Brenneman relationship, which I always thought was a real something you had to kind of
just
get through.
Well, the relationship between Val Kilmer and Ashley Judd in this film, to me, and we were saying this once again earlier before, but it is kind of like very much one of the most interesting parts of the movie to me. And
I 100% agree. Their central relationship, there's two central relationships in this movie. One of them is Pacino and De Niro, and the other one is Chris and Charlene Chihelis. Like, they're the, despite their
own mother. And it feels just so, it's resonant, isn't it?
With very little screen time and very little backstory, you really peer around the corners of what seems like a real relationship and a history. It just speaks to a lot more going on.
Well, like,
outside the frame.
Yeah.
From you two both being in, being filmmakers who've been part of big car shows, like, this is, for 1995, this film has 70-odd speaking roles. Like, so let's just wrap our heads around 70-odd speaking roles with full-blown character moments. And even just the amazing sequence between Dennis Haysbert and his partner, just another glimpse around the corner into a relationship. So you're thinking, like, what's funny about this, and when you break it down into 60-second increments, and we're going to get to the scene in a moment, is you end up going, they're on screen for maybe 13 minutes in the grand scheme of things. And you would think, like, it's like the whole Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, you know, the Hopkins performance. He's on screen for 6 minutes. He feels like he's on screen for days. But it's just for these little glimpses that they, like you said, I think Henry used the word resonant. They're just so resonant again and again. You want to go back and go, I love that tiny detail. I love that that interaction.
It's really funny watching this scene again. And it's really funny how she does that hand swipe. And that hand swipe is so iconic, isn't it?
Yes.
But really, it's interesting that either Mann directed her to do that hand swipe, or she came up with a hand swipe, because she could have just done it with a look.
Yeah.
Yes.
And here's where we can sort of, you know, we can get picky about it. So the scene, obviously, in the minute preceding, oh no, here it is. So we pan off the close up of her, and it's kind of doing a little bit of that Scarface scene in a camera move in Florida.
Absolutely.
To the benefit face to the cop in the window, to her direct left, who would see the hand move, I reckon.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd be close to seeing it, absolutely, because it's because the only hope that she's got, you're right, Luke, is that he's looking at the car. He's trying to make
Sheila from the... Yeah, but he can't see the car from there, and the whole scene's hinged around the fact that he can't see the car and relies on the guys on the street.
Mm.
Anyway, so we've got this lovely crane move down to the, what is it, white Trans Am.
Yes.
So this is all down at Venice where we are right now.
Still a pretty cool car.
And then you've got these great moments of waiting.
Yes.
I love this. And this is, I don't know, I didn't realize how dialogue-less this scene was until we just watched it with you.
Yeah. Mm. So, and again, cuts to, and I've talked about a couple of times, word that keeps coming out when describing Heat is like the geography of the characters. And so you love that Drucker... There's this perfect sequence that comes down to the Trans Am basketball courts there in Venice. You guys are there, so I love that you've picked a scene where you are, which is amazing. And the next piece is we go to go to Pacino in the robbery homicide division. He's there with Schwartz, and he's there with Casals, who's Wes Studi, and Jerry Trimble, who's like the only guy who's not a massively well-known Michael Mann regular in that. And there's that great scene of just anticipation. And now we get Val Kilmer, and he's got a Robert De Niro haircut. He's got the unrecognizable Robert De Niro haircut. Like, his beautiful blonde locks are gone. So and he turns around, so we're at 2 hours, 16 minutes and 42, 43 seconds, 44, and we get to about 46, and there's that great intercut with her reacting, looking down. I've just held pause on it's what will be 137 minutes, 47 seconds.
And he looks like he's genuinely in pain there. Like, he did a really good job there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, I'll just quickly go back, because early in the film, there's all this confidence and bluster, and he's got that greatness that I didn't give a fuck attitude through most of the film. But here, he's just broken. He sort of hobbles around. His eyes look glazed over, like he's got meds.
He's quite codeined up.
And he's turned around, and then it's like when he sees her, there's a bit of a lightning strike. There he is.
He can't help but give the pearlies.
Yeah. He can't give the Val smile.
Val smile. We've seen it in many years.
What breaks, What breaks your heart more than the vowel smile is when it goes away.
Yeah, exactly. And look at, I mean, Ashley Judd.
She's what were you saying about Southern women?
Well, that's the thing. The thing that I think is so great about the two or three scenes she has, and how that character just, you know, takes up the space even against De Niro. I think it's really true to her character, and obviously her from where she comes from. Southern women are so fucking strong and centered.
Yes.
And in a terrifyingly sort of, they have a lot more gravity than other people. And I love that she can, I believe her standing up to him and being his equal and, you know, like partner in life.
And he has to negotiate. A lot of people forget that De Niro doesn't negotiate with almost anyone in this movie. Like, he doesn't...
Only her.
That's it. In that earlier sequence.
In the great coat hanger scene.
Dynamite.
But we were talking about the block. I know this is off topic. We were talking about the blocking of that scene.
Yeah, I love it.
And they would have gone, you know... I don't know if it would have been De Niro or...
De Niro was like, I need something to hit. You know, it feels like the coat hanger...
He's done it a few times.
Yeah, but it's like... It just feels like those coat hangers are there for him to use to bash out the way. And that's kind of like, whether that was his choice
or...
That's the button. That's the button of the scene.
That's him losing. Like, I think that that's way less about the intimidation of threatening to hit her, because I don't ever think that he's going to hit her. I think it's more that he's pissed off that he has to negotiate with her in that moment, right? He's just like, God damn it, I don't want to have this conversation with you. Listen, I usually can give a directive and it's taken. But in that moment, it's I wonder that.
It's a terrific moment. Yeah.
But Henry, quick question from you from an actor's perspective. How many times are you in a moment like that and you're blocking a scene and you see something that's in the scene and go, I need to use that? Like, is that a regular occurrence?
Well, it's really fun. Like, with that particular scene.
Depends how insecure you are on the day.
Yeah, and it's sort of like, it's kind of like he needed something to hit or swipe or something. And it's like, De Niro is such a great actor, right? It's like lesser actors probably would have punched the wall or something like that.
Yeah.
But he does this great moment of sweeping away the hangers, and it's like, it's such a – the effect is all there.
Yes.
But it's not really aggressive.
Yes.
And it's not aggressive towards her. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's kind of indirect, but he's making his point.
And he's got it cornered, so that's enough.
Yeah.
And he's got the finger out.
But he just – I mean, he's just such a great – De Niro has just a great sense of how to play of tone in scenes, I think.
Yeah, and he doesn't like suck the oxygen out of her performance. Like, he gives her space still, which is not inappropriate for the scene because it's negotiating. But she gives it right back, and she's scared.
She does.
She hesitates, and it feels real.
It feels real. But I love how De Niro says he's all business. You know, there's nothing unnecessary in his acting, which is, it's so economical, which I love. And Pacino is the opposite, you know? Which is great too.
Yes,
but
and perfect for the interplay of this entire scene that we're about to see. So we've got 7 remaining seconds in this scene, and you've got to love how the smile transitions here. It's just this is Pete Kilmer. How good was Val Kilmer at this time?
Yeah, this is Pete Kilmer.
We were talking about this moment too. Like, okay, so they've just pulled off a big bank heist. Half their guys are dead, but they don't know where the other guys are. Everyone's on their own now.
Yes.
They've got to make their way out of LA somehow with whoever they want, you know.
Yeah.
But we've all been taught you've got to walk away, right?
Yeah.
So why is it such a surprise to him? Like, wouldn't he maybe be a little more cautious with the – I don't know. This is stuff I've thought about.
Right.
Like, he seems so shocked that she does the little –
I think he's shocked more that they got the way that I've always viewed it is I feel like he's more shocked that they got to her, because I think he's even quite oblivious that De Niro gets to her. You know, because that's a great
lead-in. Yeah, he never finds out.
No, that's a very much, listen, here's the deal. You know, you'll give him one more shot. Otherwise, I'll finance you and you can go away. So it feels way more like a conversation that's happening in isolation. So the fact that she's there, that's what I love about this. We're going to get into when we finally get into this next minute. I love the reaction on his face, because it's chunking information like, holy shit, they got to her. How did they get to her? How did they get to her? How did she get caught to get to this moment? And what's she being manipulated with? You know, it's like all this stuff going on at the same time, and it's like a collision. It just happens all in like half a second, and then he goes, okay. And that's the economy. No, no, he's just like, okay.
That's amazing, that world on his face, those things. And some of that's projected onto him by us.
Yeah, it is. But, I mean, I feel like Val is doing – he's doing a lot, you know.
He's doing a lot.
You know, and also the choice to – I mean, the kind of – to cut to the falling smile.
Yeah.
Which, you know, which is kind of bold. You know, it's a bold choice, but it's sort of says it all, really, doesn't it? I mean –
And,
but it is sort of, I mean, this, like, once again, it's kind of, it's sort of, it's fairy tale-ish or fantastical or something, this whole sequence.
Yeah, it's a little heightened. And,
yeah.
But it's, it goes with, you know, you've got 2 hours to kind of precede this and load it up.
Mm. Yes.
And they do it all with looks, which I think there's so many less beats to their resolution.
Yeah.
And you know, it resolves on her. It's actually her story.
Yeah.
We don't end on.
It's also searingly romantic, isn't it?
She's like, he's dead or gone.
Yeah.
And it's such they've done that choice since the 30s.
But you also know this is the last time they're ever going to see each other, right?
Yeah, and it's but it's,
that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they're the great loves of each other's lives.
And you don't just accept that because it's presented to you.
Mm.
It's like you believe it.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
Especially because of the transition in her face too, because like you, I think Luke, you said like fierce, strong, sort of towering presence that she is as a woman, Ashley Judd, sitting there doing it. And then when her face starts to break, I think it's even more powerful because Kilmer's face breaks before hers. So if you just go back for like a quick, if we go back, I'm sorry, I'm just playing the revolving, cycling back instant replay here for the guys as we're doing it. But there's this, her hair's blowing in the breeze. His smile goes, she's just firm. She hasn't done anything. And then her face, it's like it's on the brink of it's on the brink. And it's his face has broken that smile before she even has a reaction that glances across her face. But it's so perfect that she just lets it happen and that emotion comes, and then we've got a couple of seconds before the amazing gesture that comes up.
You could spend a long time cutting a scene like this, like really fine-tuning. And
tell me about that, Luke. Tell me about how you'd be in this room.
He'd probably shoot the shit out of it and have lots of takes and lots of angles. And
yes,
I don't know. And you know, knowing what I know from people who've worked with him, he's very anal and fastidious and detail oriented, possibly to the point driving people to madness. But you know, things like this, like. We were saying we just watched it on our own, on its own, without the context of the film.
Mm.
And it's a great scene on its own, but it needs all of that preceding it to get away with it so silently.
Mm.
Yes. Because it's a film, but it's a film weirdly for its massive running time and like 70 odd speaking roles that it does have these moments where people just don't say a word. People just don't talk.
No, and that's where Michael Mann really sings. It's the non-verbal. Like it's all great.
Yes,
he's master at all stuff. But I particularly find his memorable stuff is without dialogue. You know, Last of the Mohicans would be another one. You know, all that slow-mo running stuff in the third act, and you know,
he's incredible score. The beats of that, of that scene for you as an editor, I would imagine that's pretty sublimely cut together.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, and which of the two scores in that film are you referring to? That's the other thing. Yeah. Two composers.
Yes.
Yeah. Things get heated in post production. On
there were two composers in Last Mohicans.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, didn't know that.
Trevor, someone, and anyway.
Mm.
What's some other movie like?
Other Michael Mann.
Inside is just full of beautiful moments without dialogue.
It opens with Al Pacino's head in a bag, in a car, and just like a score going along, and you sort of see a kind of a flash of a first-person perspective of what it looks like to be through the bag, and then the cars sort of floating through the streets to a sheikh's house. I think it's in Lebanon, I believe, is where the opening of that 60-minute sequence is set. So, yeah, pretty Yeah. The peak man period, we've talked about peak Kilmer, peak Judd. The peak man period is like you've kind of got 92 with Last of the Mohicans, you've got 95 with Heat, and then you've got 97 with The Insider. They're kind of his probably three of his arguably best films. And you've got Thief back in the day is probably another his other one that sort of announced his arrival. But he's a bit funny, man, because he didn't really start making cinema until much later. So even though he kind of carries all of that same baggage as, you know, his contemporaries would be like Malick and Scorsese and Coppola and to an extent Spielberg, Lucas, those guys who all came out of that period, Cassavetes, he sort of pushed it all back and started making films way after all of those guys had already made like 5 or 10 films.
Yeah, well, he correct me if I'm wrong, but he sort of came from TV, did he not? And before that, he was a sort of Chicago, was he into journalism or something? Or
he was,
I feel like
he was, he went to London during Vietnam in his young age, and started making documentary films. And then he came back, and TV was starting to emerge, I guess, much in the same way, but it sort of didn't really completely go all the way. But it was in the '80s where they had bigger budgets and bigger stars were coming to TV, and TV was just becoming, was infiltrating everything. And that's where he sort of started a telemovie called The Jericho Mile. He went and produced things like Miami Vice, Crime Story, like all of that was early 80s, and he was EP / director, co-writer, sort of steering that.
Wasn't he prior to that, wasn't he working for like Stephen Botchko or something on one of those cop shows and then kind of got into that stuff? So
so
he comes from a real like workhorse kind of environment, and coming from Chicago and living here for a little while, I've noticed that Chicago has a real particular flavor.
Yes,
because it's a hard fucking city, man. It's cold, racist, and alcoholic as fuck. And their humor is brutal and awesome, but it can destroy you. Like it's a tough place. So people from there tend to have this. When you trace them back, you go, I know why you're like that, because you're from Chicago.
Well, that's him. That's him, right? And, you know, he's even done the mythologized Chicago in Public Enemies later, you know, much later, did the quintessential Chicago story.
Precisely. And this story, I believe, was taken from a Chicago story between the real Neil McCauley and whoever, Al Pacino, back in the day.
Yeah.
Really? He just transposed to Los Angeles.
It was a Chicago cop. Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, a story that he'd had for decades. And I haven't talked too much about it, and I probably will talk about it. LA Takedown. Yeah, so LA Takedown. Yeah. Talking about the differences, I think it's like we've
talked...
Oh, right.
He did before Heat.
So I'm actually learning a lot about Michael Mann.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah, so LA Takedown, he did a couple of years before as a telemovie, and they were looking at it like an extended pilot. And as an extended pilot. So they sort of did it and went, no, this isn't going to go to series. It was a bit of a change up. It was and spoilers for those who haven't seen LA Takedown, but he kind of allows Wayne Grow to kill McCauley. Like McCauley gets punished, if you like, by pursuing Wayne Grow. It's this sort of weird, dark, and it's not a bad film. When you've seen Heat, it's terrible because you see all the things that he's done to make the story better. So if you've seen it before,
I think he only had like 16 days to shoot LA Takedown. Like it shows.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's real TV stuff.
It's really TV. Really TV. Sets are pretty terrible. None of the sequences are fully funded like you would see in this.
But he could see there was a glowing ember that wouldn't go out with that botched version. So I love that. And I remember I came from the Northern Territory, and I used to come down to Sydney for holidays a lot. And there was this, I bought the script of Heat before I saw the movie, like a couple of weeks before. And it was a fucking, phone book.
Yes.
But it's, you should, I mean, I'm sure you've read it, but you should read it. Maybe not having seen the movie recently. It's really strong.
Mm.
Yes.
You know, it's long as hell.
Mm.
It's long because it's very particular, as you talked about fastidiousness. Everything is beat. He's just because so much of it's happening wordlessly. It's all described. It's all there on the page for the actors. I mean, you know, he's renowned for being crazy when it comes to preparation, but you know, he had it all there in the piece of paper.
Mm.
Where is in Northern Territory? Is that back home, Luke? Does that script still exist? Do you still have your Heat script somewhere?
Yeah, where is that?
Oh fuck! Probably somewhere in a box. I tend to keep stuff, but I've got stuff all over the place.
Same here.
All over the world.
Well, guys, we've talked about it so much, and I want to. We're going to have to watch it, but the way that this show One Heat Minute works is that we have to end this episode before we kick off the next one. So would you please join me for the next minute of Heat to see the payoff of this scene?
What can happen?
Yeah.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. Guys, thank you so much for listening to One Heat Minute. My guests have been Luke Doolan and Henry Nixon. We are going to be back for the 138th minute of Michael Mann's 1995 LA crime opus Heat very soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.